days before COVID, the 9:25 class, you could look down the hall. Even at this time, there'd be a flurry of activity. Lots of people coming and going. And look at what we got now. Half. For shame. All right. So, Age of Reason, Enlightenment, thinkers started doing the scientific revolution type stuff. They started observing the way institutions of man were operating, government, churches, the economy, and they tried figuring it out. And then once they got to that point, they started asking questions to ensure that they understood how it worked. And then when they found areas that were abusive, causing harm, they offered alternatives. We started off, most of the people associated were philosophers. None of them were actually government officials. None of them were high-ranking members of the church, which makes this movement different than everything else that we've discovered, but also other intellectual developments of the past, where it was usually church-led, because the only people who could read or write were members of the church. Thanks to the conciliarist movement, thanks to the Protestants pushing for Bibles printed in their own languages, that caused literacy rates to spike, which suddenly meant people could read and they could write. And by the 18th century, we started having treatises, books written on political matters, on religious matters. We started off with religion. I don't know why. That's what I decided to do when I made this class years ago. And I gave you one example. And again, keep in mind, each of these three big areas, there were dozens and dozens and dozens of philosophers who injected their opinions. I just like Voltaire because in all his works, he was consistent. He was consistent. He basically did not necessarily question faith, but what he did is he questioned the institutions. The man-made governmental structures of these churches. And he basically said the only reason why they exist is to control people. Because at the end of the day, you know, people are awful. Human beings are just nasty creatures. And while even the most tyrannical government cannot keep people, all people in check, if there's some type of pressure, it will keep most people in check. And ultimately, in order to have a peaceful society, you need to keep most of the people in check. So, you want to keep people in check? Make them fearful of going to hell. And they'll behave. Because no rational human being would want to, even if it's a possibility, I would hope, of there actually being a hell. I don't know. I'm not going to find out till I die. But when that day comes, and if there is a hell, I don't want to go there. So why take the risk? So, if we're not going to have an institutionalized church with appointed figures and offices and rules and structures, what would be the alternative? Well, many philosophers, including Voltaire, argued for an alternative version of religion that would become, to a degree, popularized with some of our founding fathers. And it would be deism. Deism. Deism is a word that derives from the Latin word from God, Deus. Deism is I want to be precise. Religion, in its truest sense of the word, does not mean the institutionalized churches. Religion means the philosophy of which that institution preaches. So this essentially was a religious philosophy that eliminated the institution. One of the biggest aspects of this
was the view of God himself. According to the church, in all the churches, all of the great religions, the creator, be it God, be it Yahweh, be it Allah, be it was the Japanese goddess of creation, Omikami, I can't remember her second name. But all religions have some force that created life. And most of those religions strongly imply that God, or God, the gods, are active in the world. That they come down to earth. That they engage in human beings. They take the form of a burning bush. Tell Moses the Ten Commandments. You know, things like that. That they actually interact with human beings. Well, the deists, they take a different approach. They take a different approach. Deists believe that God is the creator because, and there's been no one able that I know of that's been able to refute this point. Nothing comes from nothing. Things just don't spontaneously exist. Everything that is tangible has to be created. Has to come from something, somewhere. So these deists believe that there was something. Again, be it a god, be it the Big Bang, whatever. There was something responsible for the creation of existence and life. They are the creator. But, like watchmakers, who for centuries on end were some of the most highly skilled mechanics, and we're not talking the digital things. We're talking the old-fashioned watches that you had to wind up. All of those used to be made by hand, which meant that every single gear, every single spring, every single arm had to be custom made, custom filed down with nearly microscopic precision in order for it to work. But then, like the watchmaker, once he makes the creation, he lets it go. Deists believe that the creator, or entity or thing that's responsible for creation, made earth, made life, but does not interfere. But instead has let it go.
So in other words, we're on our own. Now, that's not to imply this is atheism. Farthest from the truth. Atheists and their religion denies the existence of creation. Deists instead argued for a more naturalized religion, where the rules of the faith were based on the way nature works.
So, we're not getting concerned with the man-made stuff, the man-made rules.
In many ways, the deists argued the same things that Bruno argued, that crazy monk who was one of the first people to suggest there could be E.T., so if we could make our faith similar to how nature works, instead of fighting nature, we could be a better part of it. So what does this mean? Well, this means at the end of the day, all of the holy books are wrong. All of the holy books are wrong. Because if the Creator actually intervened in day-to-day life, look at the way the world is now. One would think the world is so effed up that now, if any time, would be the time for a god to come down and say, hey, human beings, stop being stupid. But where are they?
This line of thought would be a sledgehammer that would serve to knock out one of the pillars that undermined, or rather, that held up society at the beginning of the 18th century. M-
monarchies.
Every single country in Europe had monarchs.
And even in places like England that had a constitutional monarchy, those kings could argue to a degree that they are kings because God wanted them to be. Well, here's the kicker. If God created everything and left us alone, can someone claim then that God gave them authority to have the power to rule over man?
Question.
Well, this would directly have an impact on the political discourse of the 18th century.
A time again when all there was monarchs.
And you had the division.
You had the constitutional monarchs in England, limited by the English Bill of Rights.
Or you had the absolutist monarchs like Louis XV. Who was able to take advantage of the system made by his great-grandfather, Louis XIV. Being able to literally have the power to use his words and destroy people's lives.
That's all there was. There were kings. There were nobilities. That was what society was. But if there is no God, can that person claim they have a divine right to rule? Well, there were many philosophers who said no. But the question then comes, well, what's the alternative? If we're not going to be subjugated by a monos archen, one ruler, what else do we do? Well, one of the first writers to suggest an alternative during the Age of Reason was Badin Lebesgue de Montesquieu. He himself was a French noble who wrote a book called The Spirit of the Laws. Now, by the way, like Voltaire, Montesquieu was not his real name. It was a pen name. Because even though he was a noble, if he would have put his pen name, the king would not be pleased. So in The Spirit of the Laws, Montesquieu argued simply that giving all power to one person was a bad idea. I mean, again, we'll go back to Louis XIV as opposed to Louis XV, we're not really going to get into it. During Louis XIV's reign, you could not have a business unless the king signed your license. You could not buy property unless the king signed off on it. You could not move unless the king allowed you to move. You could not leave unless the king allowed you to leave. And if you dared question, you literally could be shot. Well, Montesquieu argued that even if the person who has all the power is a good person, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Even if the person who gets all the power was good going in, at the end, they will be corrupted. Because power goes to one's head. If you ever want to watch something fascinating, and I'm sure you could still find it on YouTube, back in the 1970s, I forgot which college it was, but they decided to do an experiment where they took a bunch of volunteers and they locked them into a building. Half of the people that were going to be there were told they were going to be prison guards, and the other half, college students, were told they were prisoners. Do you want to see what happens when somebody has power over someone else? Just watch that. Did you watch it? What happened?
Did they start attacking and stuff and like actually was like acting like they had authority over them?
Oh yeah.
It was just a joke.
So, So kids engaging in a little experiment, all equal going in, but the people who were told they had authority over, they completely abused it. They were violent. They assaulted. They harassed. It got so out of control, the professors had to stop it. So Montesquieu, in the spirit of the laws, essentially said, look, there's got to be a better way. So you know what he argued for? He was one of the first people to do it. He said that you should take all the power of government and separate it. So in other words, don't give it all to one person. Divide it up into separate entities, which of course today we refer to as branches. Branches of government. So, what do we got? Well,
what are the basic powers of government? What are the basic powers of government? Government can make the rules that we have to follow, right? And then once government makes the rules, the government can enforce those rules. And then, of course, what happens if you break the rules? Government can punish you. Well, in France, Louis had all that. He had the legislative power, the lawmaking power. He had the executive power, the enforcement power. And he had the judicial power to punish people for violating the laws.
So what Montesquieu basically said is, well, why don't we take all of that power and divide it up? Why don't we have a lawmaking branch? Why don't we have an executive branch? Why don't we have a judicial branch? Now, ironically, what he was drawing on was the old Roman Republic. The Romans themselves were terrified of giving all authority to one person, so they created what would become known as a republic.
But the interesting thing about Montesquieu's republic is he suggested that the people should have a say in the legislative branch. So there should be some type of elections. So the people elect the legislators. So the people will make, or rather the legislative branch, will make laws based upon what the people want. You know, going back to Locke's social contract. Well, the only way to check the people, all the people, is by giving the executive authority to one person. So he said we should still have kings. Because the kings are not answerable to anybody else other than God. So they can be trusted to enforce the laws of the people. But what happens if the king abuses his power? Well, checks and balances. So let's let the legislative branch pick the judges. And the judges can basically decide when the king is right and when the king is wrong.
At the end of the day, this would make the government work for the people, not for the leaders themselves. Because the only way to have a stable, fair society is to not allow the men to make subjective decisions. Not allow them to decide whatever they want and that's the rule for everybody. No.
Rather, you codify the law. You come up with the rules and you write it down. And you make the rules plain and easy to understand. That way, you can hold the legislative branch accountable based on the social contract. You can hold the king accountable based on the social contract. And you could even hold the judges accountable under the social contract.
Thus, his alternative to a monarchy would be a republic. A republic. Questions? Now, ironically, Montesquieu was like most of the philosophers. He's making his suggestions, and like all human beings, he had a tendency to attack people who disagreed with him. But one of the things that I love in the spirit of laws, he basically says, anyone who doesn't agree with them are basically enslaved. Because all other forms of government are enslavement. You can't have a democracy, because that's mob rule. You can't have a monarchy, because that's rule of one. Either way, you're enslaved. But rather, the only way to be free is to separate power, put checks and balances in, and make sure the interests of the people are protected.
No questions.
Bless you. Oh, here we go. Other forms of slavery. Forms of government.
All right. Now, needless to say, politics are politics, and everyone has opinions on politics. And if you don't have opinions on politics, you should. You should definitely have opinions on politics. Because that's all politics are, people's opinions. And if you say, oh, I don't like politics, you're basically saying that you have no say, that your opinion doesn't matter. Never, 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 never believe that. Your opinion's as important as the next guy or gal.
Well, somebody who had a different opinion on politics was Rousseau. Rousseau was of a new generation of thinkers that were born at the tail end of Louis XV's reign in France. He himself was a noble. He himself also had to write under a pseudonym. But he went beyond Montesquieu. He didn't look to Rome as the solution. No, 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 no. He looked to the ancient Greeks. In his 1762 work, The Social Contract, Rousseau argued that the only way the people can protect their rights is to control everything. He advocated for a true democracy. The republic in Latin is res publica, which means the public realm. Democracy in Latin is demos kratia. So under a republic, the state rules. Under a democracy, demos, the people rule. He, in his work, looked to what took place in the city-states of ancient Greece, in particular Athens, which was for about 80 or 90 years, no, actually maybe it was a little more than that, maybe like 150 to 200 years, it basically was a pure democracy. Took them a while to get there. There was a lot of blood and death. But before they went to war with the Spartans in the Peloponnesian War, Athens attained a position where all citizens had the right not only to vote, but also to participate in government. I suppose I should put a little mental note in there. Of course, the total population of Athens that were citizens was only about 10%. Because only males could be citizens, no women. You had to be an adult. I think you had to be 20, if I remember correctly. Might have been 20. It wasn't 21. Might have been 22. I'll just say 20, just for giggles. All right, so I believe you had to be an adult. You also had to prove that you were a natural-born citizen. While the Greeks weren't necessarily fond of immigration, if you were a Greek, you could, with reasonable success, moved to many of the different citizens, city-states. But unless you could trace your family back to the origins of Athens, you were not allowed to be a citizen. So of the total population, about 10%, say, could participate. But they had full control over everything. They controlled the state through what is called the ecclesia, which is a citizens' assembly. All citizens were expected to serve in the ecclesia at some point on their life. If not, they were mocked,
shunned, and the ecclesia made all decisions. Of course, the big decisions are taxes and war and peace.
This was something that Rousseau believed was the truest way to protect the people's rights. Working off of Locke's contract theory, Rousseau argued that it's the people that choose the form of government. It's the people who create society. Therefore, since the people are the creators, government and society should only exist for the people. Now, of course, there's a catch. If the people make the rules, people make the laws, this means everybody in that society is obligated to obey the people. So, if 51% of the people make a law, the 49% who didn't vote for it are obligated to obey. They have no choice. Because as Rousseau argued, majoritarianism. If there's a democracy, and it's the people making the decisions, and if a majority of the people want a law, then that's the law. That represents the general will. And people must serve the general will. Because after all, it makes no sense that the majority bows to the minority. Because the majority, by default, is the most people. Why should the most have to bow down to the few? It makes no sense if all people are equal.
To renounce liberty is to renounce being a man. Rousseau argued that freedom comes from obeying the laws that you have a chance to make.
If you have a say and you participate, there's your freedom. You made the rules, now you gotta follow them.
But here's the dark side. If 51% pass a law that say people of a particular religion can't live in that society, guess what happens to those people of that particular religion? By default, majority rules. They're gone. If the majority says a group of people can't own property, well, guess what happens to that group of people? Under Rousseau, they can't own property. If the majority says we're not going to give those people the same protections under the law because we don't like them, majoritarianism, those people have no rights. FYI, that's the reason why, if anyone ever tells you we live in a democracy, they're lying to you. Because our founding fathers understood the danger of mob rule. That's why they gave us a republic.
Granted, we don't have a king, but we do have a president. Questions?
And by the way, why do they lie to you and say that we have a democracy? Well, it's subliminal word association.
If you hear the word democracy, the vast majority of people are subconsciously going to lean towards Democrats, which is going to allow the Democrats, one group of people, to get into power. And I'm not saying the Republicans are good or bad. I'm just saying that's the mental games that they play. And most people fall for it,
which is sad. But that's politics, my friends. There's no truth in politics. All right. Economics. So we're going to come up with an alternative religion. We're going to come up with alternative forms of government. What about the economy itself? Well, under the Louis, under that system of absolutism, you're only allowed to be involved in the economy if the king allows you to. If the king wants to take your house, the king can take your house. If the king wants to take your business, the king can take your business. If the king wants to take your ship, your farm, your goats, the king can do whatever he wants. So if your stuff is not yours and the government can take it, do you have freedom? Well, many of the philosophers would take the position that the fundamental right of human existence, besides life and liberty, is the right to own property. If you are not allowed to own your stuff, and someone else can take it from you, you are not free. You are a slave. So the philosophers associated with discussions on the economy, they basically argue that government should get out of the way and allow people to get more property. They should be able to start their own businesses. They should be allowed to make lots of money. They should be allowed to hire employees. They should go have their businesses. They should be allowed to produce and distribute. All free of government interference. This, they argued, is the greatest way to improve the overall society itself. You all have no idea how lucky you are to live here now. Our so-called poor people are rich compared to the populations on the vast majority of territory on this little rock that we call home. You want to know true poverty? Go to like Haiti. Go into the middle of Africa. Go into China. If you want to see poverty. Because if you have a roof over your head, if you can get your little idiot device, your little cell phone, and you can get cell service, and you can get food in your belly, you can have clothes on, and you can get a car, you're not poor. And don't get me going on the people that are homeless. The vast majority of people who are homeless are doing it because they want to do it. It's their choice. They have the ability to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. One of my favorite mental images was you drive through Worcester and you got the people saying, I'm homeless, I need a job. And they'll be on like all the corners. And you happen to look at some of the businesses that are nearby, help wanted. It's like, okay, if you really want to improve yourself, put your sign down, go get a job. Go work. And thus, you can earn your own stuff. Freedom.
Well, hands down, the leading voice amongst the philosophers vis-a-vis economics was a Scottish professor by the name of Adam Smith, who, ironically, in 1776,
published a book called The Wealth of Nations. This book is regarded as the blueprint for capitalism. The only economic system ever devised in which the individual can succeed or fail. Based on these right here. Their own two hands. In his book, he argued for laissez-faire capitalism. A capitalist economy where the government stays out. Laissez-faire, hands off. It allows those engaged in business to engage in business. To start a company. To sell a product or provide a service. And to profit. Smith argued that in such an environment where the markets are allowed to be free, unencumbered by government, uninterfered with by government, then, like a tide coming in, everybody within the economy will benefit. Rich people. Rich people have money because at some point, someone in their family worked hard and made that money. They will lose that money if they don't continue to work hard. But what do they do with their money? They want fancy things. They want nice stuff. Who's going to give it to them? They can't do it themselves. They're going to get it from somebody, right? So here you go. If you're capable of producing something that that rich person wants, that rich person is going to buy it from you. And then guess what happens to your bank account? You got money. And what can you do with that money? Well, maybe you want to go get something nice for yourself. So you take a portion of that money and you give it to somebody else. And so forth and so forth. If the government stays out, the money will flow. And even the poorest laborer will receive pay and will be able to improve their lives. And if truly free, maybe not in their individual lifetime, but if they work hard and build, and they encourage their kids to work hard and build, and their grandkids, it's possible for any family to become wealthy. Questions? All right. So how should it work? Well, he basically argued, people aren't going to get rich if you do things the way that most of the world was for a good chunk of its history, where you'd have a small family farm. And on that farm, the family basically produced everything they need. You know, they're never going to improve them, their position. They're never going to have a better life because they're always stuck. But if you take different steps of labor and divide them into different companies or different firms or different groups, then one will interact with another. And again, that flow of money will occur. And the tides will rise. What will eventually happen? More will be produced and prices will come down. Which means suddenly even the people of middle class or the people of modest means can afford nice things. Because wealth spreads best when allowed to flow. And what's the value of wealth? Well, that's in the eye of the beholder. If you have money in your pocket and you see something that you want, is the price
worth it to you? Well, that's completely up to you. I know people who spend every single penny they have
and get themselves all of the latest fashions with all of the right brand names and all of the latest little bells and whistle devices.
And they just keep spending and spending and spending. If that's what you want to do, that's fine. That's your choice.
Because your money, you're directly linking it to tangible items. And thus the value. That's the value. That's what the worth is to you. But ultimately, that value isn't divided by class. There are things that poor people want. There are things that middle class people want. There are things that rich people want. Ultimately, it's subject to the highest bidder. Nothing that annoys me worse is that when you have a whole bunch of rich people like bidding on art and someone pays like $3.5 million for a painting. And every now and then I'll hear someone be like, "Oh, why did they waste their money on that?" I don't have class envy. My response is always the same, because they wanted it. It was important to them. So good for them.
So should there be any type of regulations? No. Adam Smith basically says the markets will self-fluctuate. You don't need government involving itself in it,
or any type of force or agency, because all that's going to do is corrupt it. But rather allow the market to work. I mean, if you have a company and you're selling widgets, and there's no demand for widgets, guess what's going to happen to your company? It's going to fail. And it's stupid on you for having a business that sold a product that people didn't want. But if you come up with something that people want, should you not be allowed to make as much money as you can? The invisible hand.
So what could destroy an economy? Well, the government. The government.
The government doesn't exist to protect the interests of everybody. The government exists to protect itself. And the problem with government is you have people in there that aren't interested in serving the people, but only interested in serving themselves. So, like, yesterday on Saturday, or maybe it was Sunday, the House of Representatives made a decision to take billions of our tax dollars and they're going to give it to Ukraine. I think $60 billion. Well, why?
Well, very simple. That money is going to be used to buy bullets and bombs and guns that are going to be brought over to the Ukraine. Those bullets and bombs or guns are made by companies here in America. And many of the people who voted on that bill own stock in that company. So they're basically taking money out of the people's pockets to redistribute it to their own.
That's not a good thing. Nursing students, what happens if you have too much plaque in your arteries? What eventually happens to your... It stops. You know what it's like to start a business nowadays, 2024 in the United States? There's a reason why 90% of small businesses fail. It costs thousands and thousands of dollars, both in real money and in time, to get a business up and running. And even once you got it rotting, you're subject to inspections and regulations and rules. The government's now telling people how much they have to pay their employees. The government's mandating the employees have health care. All this other stuff. It's just plaque that's getting into the arteries. And so when you down drive downtown Main Street of any small town, you see small mom and pop business after mom and pop business close. They can't afford to stay open. It's just too costly. Why? Well, the government's making all these rules to cripple the businesses. Now, Smith did reserve one exception. He basically said the only thing that government should do is provide the infrastructure. So roads, water, sewerage, electricity. That's what the government should be involved in. Because if the government provides infrastructure, then everybody in society can use it. Not just a certain few, but everybody. Questions? All right. Now, the most fascinating thing about the philosophes is that while there was lots of negativity in their writings, generally speaking, overall, they were pretty optimistic. They believe that women, if properly educated, did have the ability to improve their lives, that they could progress society. But the key is twofold. Education. Society had to have opportunity to get an education. Not a biased education, but a free and open education. And students should be encouraged to think critically on anything. Because if you have that education, then you're going to produce honorable citizens. So, they said, we could do better provided good education, good people. But if you don't have a highly educated society, you're not going to end up with good people, then you're going to be miserable. Which is one of the reasons why John Adams, one of our most, bless you, important founding fathers, basically said that only people of strong faith could live successfully in our republic. Because our republic relies upon values, virtues, morals that we all have in common. And if we don't, well, again, put on the TV. Look at what's going on in our society today. Now, one of the most optimistic of the philosophers that talked along these lines was Condorcet. Ironically, he was one of the last men associated with this movement, because by the time he released his book, Europe would descend into all-out chaos and war, the wars of the French Revolution. But prior to its start, he wrote a book called The Progress of the Human Mind, published in 1793. And in it, he argued that the path to progress has already been laid out. He said, and I quote, "Why should it be regarded as a vain enterprise with some degree of probability, the course of the future destiny of mankind, to be achieved by studying the results of human history?" He argued, you use history as a tool to figure out where our ancestors got it wrong and where they got it right. And if you want to make society better, obviously, you follow the path that things turned out right, and you avoid the things that turned out wrong. Because ultimately, it's already been done. Don't be dumb and repeat the same mistakes twice. So, he strongly argued that it could be done. It could be achieved. But the key caused for a new type of society. He said you had to have a liberal economy. You had to have freedom of speech. You had to have freedom of publication. You know, authors shouldn't be afraid for their lives and forced to write onto pseudonyms. He said government should be contained with constitutions, and that power should be separated. And that society should be governed not by men, but by the rule of law. And there should be bills of rights where all of the rights of the people are clearly shown. And the most important part, at least in my humble opinion, he called for equality. He called for equality not only for men, but he said women should be given equal rights. And that all races should be given equal rights.
Because after all, we all out of mom. We literally were all created the same. So why should we not all receive the same rights?
Now, out of all of the subject areas, this is the area that I just go
Google and gaga over. Always, all my life, always fascinated by philosophy.
Well, I'm on the camp, and there are many. There are writers, modern writers, that basically said the philosophers didn't know what the hell they were talking about. But, you know, I'm a glass half full kind of guy. And I side with the historians that argue that these guys were truly prophetic. Their thought processes were way ahead of the times in which they lived. But if you put it all together, what were they prophesizing? Ready for this one? They were talking about America. The greatest created society ever devised in all of human history. America. A place where you all have the power to be whatever you want to be. Questions? I should put like an audio file in there so we can have God Bless America coming from this place. Ooh, chills. All right, so you had philosophers basically saying freedom and all the rest, and this is wonderful, this is great. But there were other writers that came up with other alternatives. And ironically, there were some philosophers who strongly believed that human beings did not have the capacity to create a better society for themselves. Because people, by their nature, are lazy, they're violent, they're vengeful, they're destructive. So, philosophers in this camp argued for what is known as enlightened despotism or enlightened absolutism. In other words, you don't get rid of the all-powerful king, but you make sure that the king is kind, benevolent, loving of his subjects. Think Elizabeth. She loved her people so much, she prevented the outbreak of religious wars in her country by forcing everyone to come together and compromise. Well, these thinkers basically argued that there are examples in history where you have these loving, compassionate, benevolent rulers achieve stability and prosperity in their societies. In ancient Greece, there were many people who countered democracies with the creation of what were known as tyrannies. Because the Greek meaning of the word tyrant isn't evil. The Greek meaning of the word tyrant is just one who takes power. So there were actually two periods in Athens, for example, when essentially there was a coup d'etat of sorts, and one person seized control of the state. And during their reigns, they paved the streets, they got water flowing, they made public libraries and baths. You know, they did good by the people.
So these philosophers basically said, look, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We don't need this republic thing. We don't need this democracy thing. No. We'll use the existing infrastructure, and we'll use that to make our lives better.
The leading advocate for this was Denis Diderot. Diderot literally is the person responsible for the first encyclopedia. Beginning in 1751 and constantly adding and revising it until his death in 1780, he collected all of the books that were written by all of the philosophers, and he put it into a multi-volume collection to allow the reader to basically say, okay, what does this person say about the government? What does this person say? What does this person say? To have all the information at your fingertips to allow you to make reasoned decisions. Well, it was Diderot who, after reading, again, Montesquieu and Rousseau and all the others, basically decided human beings kind of suck. And we can't trust them to make good decisions. Because they'll put people in power who make promises for them. Like, we'll give you free government welfare. We'll give you free government health care. We'll give you free government cell phones. Vote for me. So he basically said, not only can you not trust the people to make good decisions, you can't trust elections. Because you have evil, wicked, greedy people that would manipulate the masses. So, he argued, take the system of the Louis, the absolute monarchy, but you educate the monarch. Because after all, is it not easier to educate one person as opposed to trying to educate millions? So if that one person is properly educated, then they will do good by their people. They will implement rational reforms.
And because the ruler loves the people will be free from abuse.
Now, what are we talking about? Well, he argued for the same things that Condorcet said. He said, you should have a free press. You should have open educational opportunities. Free trade. The king should encourage capitalism because that will result in general prosperity. So the same outcome, just different means. And ironically, during his lifetime, he cited examples of a series of certain monarchs who he argued were enlightened. Don't write this list down. I'm not going to ask you who they were. Frederick II of Prussia. Catherine II of Russia. Charles III of Spain. Maria Theresa, Queen of Austria, Holy Roman Empress, and her son, Joseph II, who would become King of Austria and Emperor within the Holy Roman Empire, and last but not least, Louis XV of France. Now,
I left the reins on there just so that way you can see these were the people that were in charge of these countries when Diderot was writing.
And in the encyclopedias, he pointed out certain examples where the monarchs, for instance, abolished serfdom. So no one would be peasants anymore. Certain monarchs allowed people to actually own the lands on which they worked. Government encouraged licensing, more businesses. So there were good things going on. And he said, look, all of these rulers are wicked smart, and they love their people. But the problem is, and this is where hindsight of history comes in, when you analyze what those monarchs were doing, they weren't doing it all because they loved the people. No. Everything they implemented served some type of purpose that was not necessarily good for the people. For example, Prussia, Russia, Austria, they wanted to modernize their economies because they heard what was going on in England with the Industrial Revolution. And they sat back and thought, well, if we could get that type of revolution in our country, we could tax it more. Spain was on a decline. For 200, 300 years, Spain was the world power. But by the 18th century, they were losing their empires. They were falling apart on the verge of bankruptcy. So Charles was motivated not to help the people, but to save his state. And France, well, Louis was just working on trying to improve his economy so he could pay the debt that began or traced its way back, all the way back to Louis XIII. So he had bills to pay. And at the end of the day, everything they did only made them more powerful. Because what they began doing is they began basically removing the power of the nobles. They worked to undo the feudalistic system and replace it with an absolutist state. So instead of helping the people, they were removing the traditional checks and balances on their authority, which made them more powerful. And by the way, all of those monarchs recognize something that is so true. If I am more intelligent than you, I can control you. I can get you to do whatever I want. I can manipulate your feelings. I can manipulate your thoughts. I can manipulate your attitudes. So these kings and queens basically regarded their subjects as stupid little children. So if they said clever things, like to quote my favorite actor president, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, oh man. Slick Willie. Whew. He played politics really, really well. He actually hired someone from Hollywood to teach him how to cry on demand. That's how committed he was. Because you know what he used to say all the time? I can feel your pain. He made people think that he cared about them. He was just playing them. Because if you care about a politician, you're going to vote for him. Or if you think the politician cares about you. Just like the people who go crazy. Oh my God, Taylor Swift released a new album. I got to go get it because she speaks to me. She doesn't care about you. She just wants your ka-ching. But people believe it. How do you have freedom? This is your freedom. Use it, because people are using theirs against you. So, these monarchs intentionally did things to make the people think that they cared, And in every instance, when things started getting out of control, they removed those freedoms. For example, Frederick II. He was one of the first Central and Eastern European monarchs to by law abolish serfdom. Up until his reign, if you were the vast majority of people under the law, you literally were the property of your nobles, like a slave. Well, he got rid of that status. He said, now everyone is a citizen, which made the people say, yay, we love you. But you know what he didn't do? He intentionally didn't change all of the laws and the powers that the nobles had over the people. So he literally just changed the name. But the structure was still there. Joseph II. He decided to liberalize publishing laws. He sought to end censorship. Well, that was until pamphlets on the French Revolution suddenly showed up in Austria, in which some people were basically saying that they needed to do to him what the French did to Louis XVI. The guillotine. So the moment that happened, no more free press. Catherine the Great, she gave Diderot a pension, invited him to Russia, and allowed him to write propaganda to make the Russian people love her. But you know what she never did? She never lowered the taxes. She never changed the status of the population. But the people referred to her as Catherine the Great because she can feel your pain too. Questions? So the reality was, excusing absolutism allowed absolutism to become more powerful. They intentionally utilized the promise of the Enlightenment that things will get better to only make themselves more powerful. And with the state more powerful, that allowed them to get more money. And with more money, they could get more territory, more land. And from that more land, they could in the end get more power. Questions? So here is really what happened with these enlightened monarchs. Again, we don't have time to talk about it. But in the 18th century, the 1700s, there was a seemingly never-ending stream of warfare. There were wars after wars after wars. And each of these wars were motivated by one king trying to get more power, more land, more money at the expense of others. So they used their brains for their own self-gain and they triggered death and destruction. All it was about, wars. Now the weird thing was, is while there weren't world wars yet, there definitely were two basic teams, for the most part. With every single war that took place, there was on one side England, and on the other, there was France. In each of the wars, they ended up having their own separate allies. But at the core, it was England and France. And there were wars being fought in Europe, but thanks to the Age of Exploration, there were wars being fought elsewhere. In particular, here in North America. There was the... Oh, I'm going to forget. It was when Queen Victoria was on the throne. I can't remember. We ended up taking like Cape Breton Island. There was like one little war there. And then there was like King George's War. And I mean, it was just like wars and wars and wars, and the colonists here were involved. But ultimately, what it was England and France fighting over who's going to control North America. Of all the wars, the biggest war was a war called the Seven Years' War. Because guess how long it lasted? What gave it away? 1756 until 1763. And again, on one side was England, on the other side was France. Now, the funny thing was, is that the Seven Years' War did have battles fought in Europe and over here. In Europe, the war started because of the way the previous war had ended. It was called the War of Austrian Succession. 1747, the war came to an end, and Austria got more land that Prussia wanted. So they didn't like the way it ended, so they started another war. But what caused the shots over there to be fired was something that happened over here. 1755, a 20-year-old Virginian gets hired by the royal governor of the colony of Virginia because this 20-year-old was a land surveyor. So he was hired by the governor to go out and mark out property that Virginia had claimed. He ended up out near where the modern city of Pittsburgh was, or is today, wasn't there yet. Because under the original grant for the colony of Virginia, the northern boundary of the colony, the southern boundary of the colony, basically went in a straight line all the way across the continent. So the governor had a lot of money, and he wanted to take possession of some land in and around Pittsburgh so he could sell it and put the money in his bank account. So he sent this 20-year-old out there to go survey it. So because they're going out in the middle of the woods and there's Indians out there that wanted to scalp them some white men, this 20-year-old took a detachment of the Virginia militia and they went out and they began land survey. But when they got out to the modern site of Pittsburgh, much to their shock and their horror, they came across a military fort that had flying over it French flag. Fort Duquesne. Well, the surveyor basically quickly went back to the governor and said, "Governor, the French are there." So what does the governor do? He sends out a larger military force. And they're told to give to the French orders to vacate. Well, needless to say, the French weren't going to vacate it because the French said, well, ever since we established the colony of New France, we claim this land. This is part of our colony because the French had surveyed it previously. Now you had a situation, two people wanted the same piece of property. Who's going to win? Well, stupidly, the Virginian had his men fire upon the French. And then the French fired back. But the French had the support of the Indians, so they ended up catching all the Virginians. And technically, an act of war had occurred. But instead of executing the leader of this expedition, he was sent back to the governor with a note basically from the French commander saying, "This is our land, go pound sand, English." Well, when word got to Europe that the English colonists fired upon the French colonists, it would not be too much long after that before the English and the French were fighting one another over there, and the war would escalate here. And it's known as the French and Indian War. Last question before I let you go. Who was the surveyor? Does anyone know? How about the father of our country, George Washington? See you on, what day is today? Tuesday? See you on Thursday.